Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We're going to start with some music, and this is a really touching song, a duet by Yoko Ono and Anohni, which was formerly Anthony Haggerty. And so this is a song I think originally written by Yoko Ono and then re-recorded for this duet with Anohni. So here is that now. I love you, Earth.
I love you, Earth. You are beautiful. I love the way you say it now. I love you, I love you, I love you, Earth. I love you, I love you, I love you now.
I love you, Earth, you are beautiful. I love the way you shine. I love your valleys, I love your mornings. In fact, I love you every day. I know I never said it to you. Why, I would never know. Over blue mountains, over green fields, I wanna scream about it now. I love you, I love you, I love you, Earth. I love you, I love you, I love you now. You are a meeting point of infinity.
And that was I Love You, Earth by Yoko Ono and Anohni. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We have a great show for you today. So even though it's not necessarily directly related to the environment, we can't not cover the issue of Julian Assange and the recent UK court decision to clear the way for Julian Assange's extradition to the US. Many people are calling it a terrible step for press freedoms. So we're going to go to Democracy Now! For that story now.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange could soon face criminal charges in the United States after a UK court ruled in favor of the US government's appeal to extradite him. Assange faces up to 175 years in prison in the United States under the Espionage Act for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Assange has been jailed in England for 2.5 years. Before that, he spent over 7 years in exile in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. There, he had been granted political asylum. A London district judge had ruled in January that Assange should not be extradited because it would be oppressive due to his mental health and that he would likely die by suicide in a U.S. prison. But in a ruling issued this morning, British judge Timothy Holroyd said he was satisfied with a pledge from the United States that Assange would not be held in a so-called ADX maximum security prison in Colorado. According to court documents, the U.S. won its appeal to extradite Assange due to, quote, four assurances sent in a diplomatic note in February, which include the condition that, quote, the United States retains the power to designate Mr. Assange to ADX in the event that, after entry of this assurance, he was to commit any future act that then meant he met the test for such designation. Outside the court, supporters rallied for Assange's release. This is Christophe Deloire, Secretary General of Reporters Without Borders.
We do defend Julian Assange because he's prosecuted for his contribution to journalism. Yes. Yes. And his extradition would clearly have long-standing and severe implications regarding press freedom all over the world, in this country, in the US, and beyond. Yes. And that's why there is only one legitimate option now, which is that the case is closed and that Julian is immediately released. Yeah. And I take the opportunity to call on the journalists everywhere to be totally conscious of what happens now, of what is now considered. It's really the crucial moment for all journalists everywhere to defend journalism, to defend Julian in this case. So really, act now, act before it's too late.
The British court's ruling comes as the Biden administration's hosting a global summit for democracy, where Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced U.S. efforts to support independent journalism and reporters targeted for their work.
We're asking governments to make concrete commitments to strengthen free, independent media and help tackle the diverse challenges that they face. We're increasing protection for the free press here at home. In July, the Department of Justice adopted a new policy to stop using subpoenas, warrants, and other investigative powers to obtain notes, work products, or other information from journalists engaged in news-gathering activities.
For more, we're joined by Gabriel Shipton, who is Julian Assange's brother and a filmmaker, and Ben Wisner, director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, also the legal advisor to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Jeff, let's begin, Ben Wisner, let's begin with you. Your response to the ruling by the High Court in Britain.
Well, obviously, anything that brings Julian Assange one step closer to a courtroom in the United States is a terrible step. But it's important to note that only one issue was at stake in the appeal today, and that was the judge's earlier ruling that Julian Assange should not be extradited because of the oppressive conditions of confinement that he would be exposed to that would present a suicide risk. What was not at stake in this appeal is the much more significant legal issue for global press freedom. And that is, can charges under the U.S. Espionage Act result in the extradition of a foreign publisher for publishing truthful information? And this is the issue that really journalists around the world should be watching more closely. And journalists in the United States in particular should be a lot louder about, because whatever they may think about WikiLeaks and however they may want to choose to define themselves in contrast to WikiLeaks, this is a precedent that is going to affect every investigative journalist in the United States.
And let me get the response of Gabriel Shipton. You are Julian Assange's brother. You're a filmmaker. We've had you on before with your father talking about this case. Your response to this breaking news that Julian Assange could be now sent to the United States, though there are still a few other legal steps that have to happen.
You know, I don't think we can ignore any longer that, you know, we can rely on the British courts to stop this extradition. The charges against Julian need to be dropped by the Biden administration and the Merrick Garland DOJ here in the US. Julian, he's been, it's been 11 years since he was first arrested in the UK. You know, he's This is going to be his third Christmas in Belmarsh maximum security prison. He's only been held in Belmarsh at the request of the US DOJ. He is not serving a sentence. The DOJ has, they're requesting that bail is not given to Julian. So really what needs to happen now is the Biden administration needs to drop these charges and let Julian go.
Can you talk about the five appeal points that were heard in this case, how Julian is right now in Britain, and what you think would happen if he were brought to the United States?
Well, I think the appeal was approved on based on the assurances given by the U.S. These assurances have been found. Amnesty International has said they're not worth the paper they're printed on. If he's extradited here, I'm sure they can't guarantee his safety in the U.S. prison system. He will likely die here, if not beforehand. So that's really, we live in fear of that happening to Julian. And as I said, it's his third Christmas in Belmarsh prison now. The conditions there, they're not good there either. He should be at home with his family. He's just, he's being crushed basically. And I'm so it's hard to put into words really, what we're seeing happening, to Julian. He's so strong and so resilient, but this whole process has really taken its toll on him.
Go ahead.
So the next stage, so Julian has now 2 weeks to appeal this decision. The High Court has ordered the Magistrates Court to approve the extradition and send it to Priti Patel to approve. So Julian has 2 weeks to appeal this decision, and we're going to keep fighting. We're going to appeal. And there is also a cross appeal in the works, which will appeal all the substantive press freedom issues as well.
I mean, I'm looking at the amnesty statement, Gabriel, and it says, they say, we guarantee that he won't be held in a maximum security facility and he will not be subjected to special administrative measures. Those are called SAMs. And he will get health care. But if he does something we don't like, we reserve the right to not guarantee him. We reserve the right to put him in a maximum security facility, Gabriel.
Yeah, that's right. And, these are the person who makes these decisions is the director of the CIA. And so, in September, we saw an expose by Yahoo News investigative journalists that found there were plots within the CIA to kidnap, to murder Julian. So really, what he has been put, his health and well-being, and he's been put in the hands of these people who had plots to murder and kidnap him. So these assurances, like I said, they're not worth the paper they're printed on. They're not assurances at all. And I think you can see what's happened with whistleblower Daniel Hale. He's been put in what's called CMU, Communication Management Unit, which is, it's almost worse than ADX Florence. So there's all these options that they have, that the prison system has at their disposal to restrict Julian's communication, to restrict his ability to communicate with other people in the prison, and just really to grind him down to dust, basically.
Ben Wisner, we're about to play the Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech of Maria Ressa. She and the Russian journalist Muratov got their awards today as the Nobel Committee in Oslo talked about celebrating freedom of expression. You're deeply concerned about this issue with Julian Assange. Is he the first publisher to face espionage charges like this in the United States? And what are the plans ACLU has signed on to letters? What are the campaigns planned right now as this process moves forward? And if you could specifically address what Julian released, this whole issue of the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, and decades of State Department communiques and memos, what this information has meant for journalism in the United States, States, for the United States and the world talking about what happens on the ground in war?
So that's a lot, but I'll do my best. Amy, first of all, yes, this is the first time in the 100-year ignominious history of the U.S. Espionage Act, which was passed during an earlier Red Scare, that someone has been prosecuted with felony charges for publishing truthful information. We've never seen a case like this. This was a Rubicon that we didn't want to see crossed. The Obama administration considered making Julian Assange the first person charged, convened a criminal grand jury, but at the end, cooler heads prevailed, and they realized that there was simply no way to distinguish the conduct that they would have to charge in this case from what investigative journalists at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker do on a daily basis. And let's remember, this case involves disclosures from 2010, 2011, that Chelsea Manning was convicted for providing to WikiLeaks. This was not something that WikiLeaks published on its own. WikiLeaks partnered with the New York Times, with Der Spiegel, with The Guardian, and those newspapers published award-winning journalism covering war crimes that the U.S. and U.K. military had committed in Iraq and in Afghanistan, diplomatic cables that shed light on our support for oppressive regimes and torture and contributed to the Arab Spring. So this was really vital information that the public around the world had a right and a need to know. And here's our concern. At the U.S. level, this indictment criminalizes investigative journalism. Now, the Justice Department wants to say this isn't journalism. This is a criminal conspiracy. He conspired with Chelsea Manning, tried to urge her, cajole her, help her to turn over U.S. government secrets. But that precisely describes what our best investigative journalists do. You could describe everything they do as a criminal conspiracy because they're trying to persuade people with access to privileged and important information to violate the law and turn it over to journalists in the public interest. So this precedent, if there is a conviction here, will chill journalists. Not, it doesn't mean that the New York Times will be prosecuted the next day, but it means their lawyers will tell their journalists that they can't publish important things because of that threat of prosecution. But there's another element here that I think ties more to the global press freedom issue, and it is ironic that it's happening on the same day that these Nobel Prizes are being awarded. And that is that the U.S. is taking the position that our secrecy laws apply criminally to foreign publishers, that someone who has no ties to the United States, who is publishing overseas, making his own determinations of public interest considerations, can be extradited and hauled into a U.S. court and prosecuted. And think about what that precedent will mean around the world. If every regime now can point to us and say, we want to extradite these journalists. Viktor Orban wants to extradite Guardian journalists to Hungary because they published Hungarian secrets. You know, the Chinese want to extradite New York Times journalists because they published Chinese secrets, which the New York Times does routinely. And again, the threat is not that the U.S. will have to send its journalists to China. It will never do that. But that we are now embracing and blessing and setting this precedent that is going to empower the worst authoritarian forces around the world. So look, I take what Gabriel says. I think we are still hoping that the UK courts will find a way to resolve this case without setting the precedent that a foreign publisher can be extradited to the United States. If that doesn't happen, it will be all hands on deck in the U.S. You know, of course, we'll be appealing again to the Merrick Garland Justice Department to find some kind of face-saving resolution here that doesn't involve setting this kind of precedent that will smear their own reputations. And if that doesn't happen, all of these groups will be in court as friends of the court, arguing strenuously that this is an intolerable prosecution under the First Amendment.
Ben Wisner, we want to thank you for being with us, director of the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project. We also want to thank Gabriel Shipton, Julian Assange's brother and filmmaker. To see all our interviews with Julian Assange, including the ones where we went inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was in political exile before being sent to the Belmarsh maximum security prison, go to democracynow.org.
And that was a story from Democracy Now! About the recent decision by a UK court to clear the way for Julian Assange's extradition to the US. Many people are calling this a terrible step for press freedom. And journalists all over the world are saying that journalists and people have to take a stand and oppose this move. If you want to find out more, you can go to democracynow.org. If you want to help Julian Assange, you can go to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks Public Defense Fund, which is on GoFundMe.com. To find out more to help Julian Assange, you can also go to defend.wikileaks.org. So you are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We'd also like to cover a story today from Radio EcoShock, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. And Richard Heinberg is a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and regarded as one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. And so Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock recently interviewed Richard Heinberg about why gas and oil prices are so high. Why is everyone rushing to produce more fossil fuels while climate catastrophe strikes all over the world? And so to get some answers, Alex Smith interviewed Richard Heinberg from the Post-Carbon Institute. Here is that interview now.
Why are gas and oil prices so high? Why is everyone rushing to produce more fossil fuels while climate catastrophe strikes all over the world? Is there a fatal misunderstanding lurking in all of our minds? We need to talk with Richard Heinberg. Richard wrote pioneering books on oil, fracking, coal, energy, and community. He's a senior fellow in residence at the Post-Carbon Institute. Richard has appeared on Radio EcoShock several times since 2009. From Santa Rosa, California, Richard Heinberg, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, Alex, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you again.
You too. Now look, we have a full agenda for our little chat here. You report a major roadblock in your new book, Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. But first, many of our listeners are super nervous about what is happening in world energy markets. You know, gas is so high at the pumps. Europe is worried about getting enough energy for heat this winter. Do you have an introductory sort of overview of energy fragility as we head into 2022?
Yeah, there are a lot of short-term causes for the high energy prices we're seeing right now, which are basically high fossil fuel prices. Coal, oil, and natural gas all are at not necessarily record prices, but historically high prices right now. Some of those proximate causes have to do with the pandemic and the whipsawing of the economy that's happened over the last 18 months, 2 years as a result of that. But in back of all of those events is something else that's going on, which nobody wants to talk about, which is simply depletion of the coal, oil, and gas that were originally present in the Earth's crust. We've been extracting these fossil fuels using the low-hanging fruit principle, getting the cheapest, easiest, and best stuff first and leaving the nasty, dirty, hard-to-get stuff for later. And it's increasingly later. So the problem that the industry is talking about is insufficient investment. There's not enough investment going into producing enough coal, oil, and natural gas to supply markets. But it's partly due to the short-term factors I was alluding to earlier. But it's also partly due to the fact that it just takes more energy and effort to find and produce these fuels than it used to. And as we go on, that situation can only get worse.
And despite the pandemic and supply chain problems, the world is still overheating. Emissions are going up because humans are dumping more greenhouse gases into the air. Nobody connects fossil fuels to the fires and floods until very lately, not the government, not the media. Do you feel that disconnect?
Oh, absolutely. See, the problem is energy is necessary for everything we do. And we've just come off of a couple of centuries of super cheap energy that enabled us to do everything faster on a larger scale. And the result was the consumer economy of the 20th century and urbanization, the growth of the middle class. All of these things, in many cases, you know, were really great, but they were predicated on having lots of cheap energy from fossil fuels. And now we're at the point where that's becoming more difficult to maintain. so do we switch energy sources? Well, of course, that's the sensible thing to do, but you can't do it on a dime. It takes planning, it takes time, it takes organization, and there may be technical limits to how much energy we can produce over any reasonable transition period like 20 to 40 years. So we're left in the lurch because we've built our economy on the assumption of perpetual growth. And if, in fact, we're in a situation where we don't have the prospect of growing our energy supplies over the next 20 to 40 years, but in fact are facing a situation where we may have to cut back on energy, well, that just changes the whole game. And policymakers don't want to think about that. That's why no one mentions depletion in their discussions of the current energy crisis, because it's not something you can solve with a wave of the hand or a new policy or even with more investment. It's something that's going to get worse inevitably.
In the TV news, there's a corner box there with a hand speaker for the deaf, and I'd like to add another one for real news about the environment. It could be like those disclaimers on pharmaceutical ads. When you buy a new gas-guzzling car or you fly the family to the tropics for a vacation, it comes with a warning label that says, well, this may also result in homelessness, mass migration, and deaths. I wonder, am I being too extreme to say that the mainstream media feels like it's become propaganda for a party of extinction?
Well, it is kind of that way. I mean, as I said just a minute ago, we depend on energy for everything. And so as soon as our energy supplies are threatened in any way, we clamor for more. Even if we've just been talking about climate change and all of the problems it's going to create for us and the possibility of, undermining agriculture and the glaciers that supply water to 2 billion people are melting and really cataclysmic impacts that are likely as a result of climate change. Just after we've had that discussion, suddenly the price of energy goes up and everybody is all about, well, can't Saudi Arabia pump some more? Shouldn't we invest more in fracking, etc.? Very little long-range thinking or contextual thinking about the moment that we're in. It's an extraordinary moment, and it really calls for some adults in the room to really think this through.
There must be two Joe Bidens, because at the start of November, we saw President Biden warning the world of climate disaster and pushing for action. America would take a leadership role. By mid-November, the other Joe Biden was bringing more oil out of the Strategic Oil Reserve. I noticed you were one of the few to comment on that. How do you read this?
Well, of course, this is a lot of hand-waving in order to avoid having to face the situation that, we're going to have to learn how to use less energy over the next while. There's really no way around it. I worked with a colleague, David Fridley, of the Energy Analysis Program at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. We worked together for a year analyzing the energy transition to solar and wind power and what would be entailed in it, what the limits would be, and so on. And our conclusion was, you can do everything in the lab. You can pull carbon out of the atmosphere. You can make synthetic fuels that will work in airliners. Basically, there are no purely technical limits to the transition. But the problem of scale is enormous, simply because we use so much energy and so much. 80% of the energy we use comes from fossil fuels. And currently, solar and wind are providing only about 3.3% of our total energy globally. So we have a long way to go, and there are some real hurdles along the path with intermittency of solar and sunlight and wind, and the materials that will be required to build the infrastructure that will be needed. Sunlight and wind are renewable, but the technologies that we use to capture them are not. They require sand for silicon, and everybody thinks sand is limitless, but it's not. We're running short of high-grade sand, but that's only one of the materials, copper, nickel, neodymium. The list goes on and on. We may have enough to build out one generation of renewable power infrastructure. But that infrastructure, much of it will require replacement every 25 years or so. So what do we do for an encore? We really have to rethink how much energy we're using.
If we picture a major oil or gas company, there are long-term plans and huge amounts of financing, which is money coming at a price over time. Now the economy accelerates or shrinks based on public fear and mutations of a virus. Richard Heinberg, can fossil fuel production survive in a stop-and-start environment? I know you've written a lot about how their financing really works.
Well, it makes it difficult because a lot of these projects are long-term projects, whether for oil, coal, or natural gas. The industry requires stable, high prices for their own internal investment. Now, of course, the external investment, people buying shares of Exxon or your favorite coal company or whatever, external investment is going down because of the divestment campaigns being run by environmentalists. Why should we invest more in coal, oil, and natural gas if these fuels have no future and they're driving us off the ecological cliff? Well, that makes perfect sense. But then the result is a lowering of the price of the shares in these companies, the stock shares. So the companies find themselves in a situation where it's actually better for their bottom line to buy back shares in their own companies than to invest in future production. That's just one of the perverse things that's going on in the fossil fuel industry right now. Then, drilling has declined in the U.S. shale patch, which has been responsible for 90% of oil production growth over the past 10 years. And also, the U.S. has done spectacularly well with shale gas, becoming a net exporter by pipeline to Mexico and by LNG tanker to Europe. But that requires constant drilling, too. I mean, all of the shale reservoirs require very high rates of drilling. But if there isn't constant investment from the industry, then production goes down, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
In the early days of the pandemic, media stories reported fossil fuel use dropped significantly due to lockdowns, work from home, canceled vacations. But when the year ended, scientists reported carbon emissions increased again anyway. It makes us wonder, what would it take to even stabilize emissions, much less reduce them? Can we?
It would require significant reduction in energy usage, especially in the highly industrialized countries. And, a lot of those carbon emissions are coming also from countries like China and India. China has become the world's top carbon emitter just because it relies so much on coal. So China is going to have to rejigger its entire energy economy over the next couple of decades. And, the Chinese know that that's what they're going to have to do, but they haven't really figured out a solution. They are developing renewables as quickly as they can, but it's not nearly fast enough to replace their reliance on coal. Meanwhile, they've been having to import coal from Australia because Chinese have used so much coal that they've depleted their own coal mines to a pretty large extent. India now is trying to do the same thing. So unless we figure out a solution for these countries, even belt tightening in countries like the U.S. is not going to make enough difference.
One last question before we get to your new book. Only a dozen years ago, you and to a certain degree I and a whole movement concluded the world would run out of fossil fuels before climate change could arrive, and that fit the scientific predictions of the day as well. Then came fracking, offshore drilling, and more. How do you see climate change and depletion interlocking today?
Oh, that's a big question. We've put off the energy transition far too long for it to be some kind of gentle, controlled process, because the transition itself is going to take a lot of energy. Building all that infrastructure, not just for solar panels and wind turbines, but and electric cars and heat pumps, but a super grid, new industrial infrastructure for using electricity rather than fuels, or new infrastructure for producing synthetic fuels with electricity that can be used in hard to electrify processes like, you know, long distance aviation, high heat processes like making cement for concrete. All of that is going to take an enormous amount of energy, and right now most of that energy, 80% of that energy, is going to have to come from fossil fuels. So ironically, we need a stable energy situation based on fossil fuels in order to manufacture the alternative energy infrastructure that we're going to need as fossil fuels deplete. But we've waited until the point where our fossil fuel-based energy system is becoming less stable. So it makes the whole transition that much more fraught, that much more difficult.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're investigating the sources of human powers. Richard Heinberg, author of the new book, Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival, is with us. And I looked through this book, I read it actually cover to cover, and it's not really a book about energy per se, about fossil fuels, solar and atomic energy. Something drove you to look for the deep narrative, the common narrative, like the water we swim in but we can't see. What was bothering you that drove you into this book?
What prompted the book was three questions that have been tumbling around in my mind for years, and I've put some effort into articulating them as simply and clearly as possible. One is, why has just one species, our species, come to dominate the rest of the biosphere in a way that no other species has in at least tens of millions of years, possibly hundreds of millions? Second, how and why have we come to dominate one another to such extent? Because, you know, there are other social animals that have hierarchies, but nothing like what human beings have created. And third, is there anything we can do to change our relationship with power, to shift our trajectory and solve some of these, you know, really, really serious environmental and social problems? Those questions led me on a search through biology and history and anthropology, evolutionary studies, and it was, I have to say, it was the intellectual journey of a lifetime. And the end result is a rather long book, but it's one that I think maybe doesn't help us to solve these problems, but helps us to see them in perspective. It's, I think my goal with the book is maybe wisdom more than a new techno fix or a new instant solution to some of these age-old problems. I look at power both in terms of energy. A physicist would define power as the rate of transfer of energy, but we use the term power in ordinary conversation to refer to the ability to use energy to do something, like the power of flight or the power of speech. And we also use it to refer to social power, the ability to get other people to do something, the ability to influence others. So I trace the history of the development of power all the way from this beginning of evolution in the book, all the way up through human social evolution, human history, the origin of the first states, and then the beginnings of the fossil fuel world we live in today, because fossil fuels have really changed our relationship with power in profound ways. And the conclusion I come to in the middle of the book is we've overpowered nature and one another. Power is a good thing. We can't do anything without it. But it's possible to have too much of a good thing, and fossil fuels have done that to us. They've given us so much power so quickly that we have forgotten that there are natural limits to just about everything we can do. We've developed kind of a Star Trek mentality that says that even if we trash this planet, we can jet off to other ones and exploit those. But that's not going to work for us. Wherever human beings have gone on this planet, they've eventually learned that they have to fit in. They have to abide by limits, and we're going to have to learn that again today. We can. Human beings have, like all other species, have learned to live within nature's structures and limits. But we've forgotten that, and if we don't learn it again fast, we're in for a collision with those limits that may not be survivable.
I want to read a short quote from your introduction. You write, "I test the widespread belief that the pursuit of power is irrepressible, that bullies will forever be bullies, that the high and mighty will ultimately triumph, and that people in wealthy countries will never willingly give up comforts and conveniences in order to forestall global environmental catastrophe," end quote. But isn't that all true?
Well, it is to a certain extent, but, you know, as I looked through nature and human history, I found instance after instance of self-limitation. Species that choose to thrive in very rare and harsh habitats where, you know, very few of them can survive, and yet those are some of the most stable species on the planet in terms of population levels. So they have traded population abundance for population stability, in effect. But all the way up through human history, the same thing, indigenous societies, you know, when people first arrived on new continents or islands, they tended to kill off the big herbivorous animals that could be used for food and caused the extinctions of all kinds of species. We're talking about things that happened 10,000 years ago and more. But once people dug in and learned to live within those environments over the long term, whether it was Australia or North America, they learned the lessons of limits, and they incorporated into their cultures the need for resource conservation and sharing. And that's why we turn to indigenous peoples today for inspiration on how to manage resources, just as we're doing here in California now with the wildfires. We're turning to Native Americans to learn about their practices of landscape management prior to the European conquest. So these cultural understandings were developed through trial and error over a long time. We don't have a long time. We need to, in a sense, re-indigenize ourselves. We're everywhere on the planet now. And if we don't learn how to be indigenous to it, you know, we're not going to be able to escape to Mars and thrive there. This is it. This is where we rise or fall.
Well, as I covered in my last week's show, we're not all going to be able to escape to the Arctic or the far north either as the climate warms, because those communities are almost entirely dependent on fossil fuels now, except for the few indigenous people who knew how to live otherwise. So that's almost like a colony that we're trying to develop built on fossil fuels. If you can't live where you are from the resources around where you are, then I would say we really shouldn't encourage that kind of development anywhere.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I mean, we have so few pristine landscapes left on this planet. We need to preserve those for the rest of the biosphere. I mean, over the last 50 years, we have caused the decline of other species, wild species, by 70%. In other words, there are 70% fewer mammals, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and so on, than there were 50 years ago, and it's all because we've taken over their habitat, we've poisoned them with pesticides and herbicides and so on. And if we don't leave more of wild nature for wild nature recovery, then the future looks very, very grim also for our own species.
As you explain in your book, not all human power comes from repressing others and taking their resources. What are some of the better sources of power that are left out of economic papers and the billionaire's playbook?
Well, I talk in the book a lot about the power of beauty. The search for beauty, the production of beauty, protection of beauty, those are motives and incentives that have driven not just human behavior, but behavior throughout the animal kingdom and even among plants. Nature puts enormous resources and effort into the production of beauty, flowering plants, animals of all kinds. Darwin talked about that in his second great book, which was about sexual selection. Much of this is about attracting mates, but once the investment is made in the production of beauty and the enjoyment of beauty, then it tends to continue with a momentum of its own long past the immediate necessity of attracting a mate. That's why birds sing, even though it's not mating season. And we humans have gotten into the beauty business in a big way. The problem, of course, is that we have created a kind of aesthetic decadence with the commercialization of beauty, where now it serves the purposes of consumption, economic growth, and our own, you know, self-undoing. If beauty could be freed from that yoke once again, so that it serves the community, the production of beauty could be a motive in human culture and human society, as it once was, that supplants the drive for competitive growth and that enables communities to cohere and that makes life beautiful for people. You know, the production of beauty does not have to be extremely energy intensive. It doesn't require the destruction of nature. It can proceed on a very modest basis and yet provide enormous returns for the people who are producing it and enjoying it. So we could have a beautiful future if we choose to.
Well, as you said, and as I found also in the French philosopher Paul Virilio, it is over-success that is killing us, and some people hope the fossil-powered system will crash before it really is too late to save ourselves and the other species. And it feels so unkind to hope for a fall in gross domestic product or an end to useless shopping. It would be a hard revolution. How do we live with the paradox of betting against our own comfortable lifestyles?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Like everyone else, I enjoy stability. I enjoy the status quo because it provides a lot of perks for us. And it's terrible to imagine a future in which we really have to give up so many of our current perks and conveniences and so on. And, of course, that's why the environmental movement back in the 1970s largely failed, is because people were being called on to, as Jimmy Carter did on television, you know, wear sweaters, turn down the thermostat, and prepare for a future of less and harder existence. Well, we gave up the chance to do that in a measured, easy way. Now the adaptation is going to be much more difficult, and it's hard to look forward to it or to welcome it or to call for it because it will entail suffering. But nevertheless, you know, from a larger perspective, it is inevitable, and the best thing we can do is prepare ourselves for it and to make the most of it. So building more social cohesion within our communities, learning to live with less now, getting to know nature by taking a permaculture course or a course on primitive technology skills, those are things we can do right now to change our attitudes, our habituations, and to learn to live in the 21st century. We're still, most of us, living in a 20th century lifestyle, but the 21st century, the rest of it, is going to be very, very different.
That's a beautiful place to leave it, Richard. From California, we've been speaking with Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and well-known author of at least a dozen books on energy, resilience, and community. I started getting his Muse letter years ago, and it's now at around issue 350, I believe. You can find out more on my blog at ecoshock.org, but of course at richardheinberg.com. Look for his new book, Power, Limits, and Prospects for Human Survival. Richard, on behalf of my listeners and your chickens, thank you for keeping going.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for keeping going, Alex. It's always a pleasure.
And that was an interview with Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute, and that was Alex Smith interviewing him on Radio EcoShock, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're basically out of time, and so you can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca, and you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. We also have a small little website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. So thanks for listening, and we'll leave you with some music, some Christmas music, as we're getting closer and closer to Christmas. And we'll leave you with What Do the Lonely Do at Christmas by The Emotions. So here that song is now.
season to be jolly. But how can I be when I have nobody? The Yuletide Carol doesn't make it better, knowing that we won't be together. A silent night, I know it's gonna be joy to the world, but it's gonna be sad for me.
Out of a lonely door at Christmas. Oh,
Christmas time. The children can play with their new toys while their little hearts burst open with joy. And lovers can kiss beneath the mistletoe. Choirs can sing those glorious songs of old. But what is there for me to do now that it's Christmas and I don't have you?
Out to the lonely door at Christmas. Mm-hmm. Oh, out to the lonely door
at Christmas.
Going to play you a song by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and this is their instrumental version of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, but they call it God Rest Ye Merry Gents. So enjoy that. This is Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
Thank you.
I'm Ryan Young, and we're going to leave you with some music. This is, I think, one of the most amazing songs I ever heard about forestry issues and the protests against clear-cut logging in British Columbia. Was a song by the Weird Sisters. They have a song called Farewell to Clackwood Sound, of course, which was a big protest movement back in the 80s or 90s, I believe, trying to save a part of British Columbia's Vancouver Island, where there was a high concentration of old-growth forest in the area around Tofino, which is called Clackwood Sound. And the Weird Sisters put out this amazing song back then, which, you know, it's a great song, sometimes sends shivers up my spine. So enjoy. Have a great rest of your day.
On Vancouver Island, forest so old, the last of her kind. She is mighty and bold, but the big blades now are mowing her down. Farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound. Well, the NDP had made a big noise, trying to play the big games with all the big boys. So they sold out her soul for hardly a cent, the raw timbers cut and elsewhere is sent. So blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Well, upwards of thousands have stood in the way, but bullies just come and take them each day. And the government too has its own saws. They're changing the charges by changing the law. So blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Live in the trees, and what of the life, the quiet, the breeze, and what of our planet when she's stripped to the ground? Farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound. So blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down.
Tame Impala in concert. Tame Impala Slow Rush Tour. An incredible transcendent live performance.
She just said, is it true?
Tame Impala, Class Bell, March 10th. Get tickets now at evenco.ca.
To prevent the spread of the virus, wear a mask in public places, such as on public transit and in grocery stores and businesses. The best way to protect your health and the health of those around you is still to follow recognized hygiene measures. For example, washing your hands regularly and keeping your distance. let's continue to protect ourselves. Find out more at quebec.ca/mask. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
I'm Noam Chomsky, speaking from MIT. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Yeah, do it for the hood, yeah. Southside with an F, cause I'm fresh. Do it for the hood, rep. Southside with an F, cause I'm fresh.
Trying to make my mama proud. I ain't trying to let my mama down. I'm just trying to make my mama proud. I ain't fooling around with you.
University, I pull it up in Mercury. Mama, how we filled up with bags of Hercules. Soon as I finish pissing, I put the seat down. Oh, my mama be done, cut my damn town. Only child, no siblings, no besties. I couldn't do nothing right like a lefty. Bought my mama first house with the jewel, man. Bought my mama second house with the club, man. Me and mama used to chop out the same house. Used to eat and go to sleep on the same couch. Me and mama got busted at the same time. When the court and told you the damn same lies, I can tell mama proud of her only son. Two chains, I have always worn more than one. Yeah, I'm real, I'm ill, you know you gotta feel. You popping pill, I'm rarer than $2 bills. Yeah, I'm just tryna make my mama proud. Yeah, I ain't tryna let my mama down. Yeah, I'm just tryna make my mama proud. Yeah.